Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Richard Brodsky, former 14-term New York State Assemblyman from Westchester and currently a senior fellow at Demos. Richard has appeared on CNN, MSNBC, Fox Business News, among many other national and statewide TV stations. He's been featured on dozens of radio stations, including NPR, WNYC, WCBS, and WINS. His op-eds have been featured in the New York Times, New York Daily News, The Capital, and other major publications. Welcome, Richard Brodsky.
Nice to be back, Alan. How are you?
I'm good. You sound different from when you were a politician. How come?
I'm taller. I sound taller.
T-A-L-L-E-R, taller?
Yeah.
I thought you might have said polar, but I know you didn't.
No.
So there's so many things I want to talk to you about because you are on the inside. You really do understand how the game is played. But I'll just say a word or two, and then you just take it. In other words, vamp, you're a piano player. Vamp till ready, otherwise known as da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, ready now? Moreland Act Commission.
Very interesting legally, and then because of that legal problem, it has sort of not functioned the way I think it was politically intended to. Moreland Act Commission cannot, by law, investigate the legislature. I think this governor resisted that legal truism, but eventually came out where his father came out, which is you needed to do, while you do a Moreland Act Commission, a separate referral to the Attorney General. That meant that this is something of a hybrid. And when the governor's office started to run the hybrid, a lot of people got upset. It's sort of out of control from a political point of view because some of the things they should have been and are now looking at involve the governor's own fundraising, which complicate what was a one-line message, the legislature's the problem.
Yeah, but I think you have, Richard, I think you have to go a little bit further and just explain how this works. So the governor appoints a Moreland Act Commission, right? And then he puts on it, and his co-conspirator in the whole thing, the Attorney General, who proceeds to deputize all the members of the commission.
That's not correct, Alan.
Oh, okay.
The legalisms matter here.
Okay, sure.
The technicalities matter. He didn't put the Attorney General on the commission. He can't do that. A Moreland Act Commission is, under law, there to investigate only the executive branch. If you want to do an investigation of the legislative branch, you have to find another way.
Yep.
That way has traditionally been what's called a, quote, referral by the governor to the Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially a separate legal act. So the governor's executive order here had two separate things in it. The authority to issue subpoenas to the legislature does not pertain to the Moreland Act Commission. It pertains to the Attorney General. So if, as has been reported, the governor's office was actually interfering, strategizing, dealing with the legislative subpoenas, then there's a legal problem. And that legal problem came back, I think, to bite the governor in the tuchus politically when it looked like he was shielding his own fundraising and focusing on the legislative fundraising. Having said all of that, the notion of an investigation is probably a good thing. There is a reform agenda to be had, but I don't think the imprecision, very fair word here, that the governor got involved with has done him or the Moreland Act Commission any good at all.
So why did he set the whole thing up? I won't quibble with you about the Attorney General, but clearly he and the governor are partners in setting this thing up and doing this thing.
Again, Alan, yeah. Respectfully, I don't think they're partners. I think there's a different perspective between the talented people on both sides. And I think that has shown. So that if you're looking at the way in which this has been reported in the last 3 or 4 weeks, the story has been, true or not, the governor's interference with this process. And that, I think, is inherent in the legal split, which the governor was never particularly anxious to acknowledge. So if you view them as joined together at the hip, it's hard to explain the breakdown. If you view them as both legally and perhaps politically separate, all of a sudden things become more understandable.
Richard, just moving that aside a little bit, I do want to know why, in your opinion, the governor decided to set up the Moreland Act Commission. He knew that there was a separation between the executive and the legislature, as you say. He set it up, but clearly it was aimed at them.
Well, one of this governor's real strengths is that he's decisive, even when he's not making the right decision. That trait shows through. I think we should take him at face value at some level. He says there ought to be an investigation of fundraising tactics, the intersection of money and politics. I think we should believe him. Now, that is where the problems arose, because as the thing unfolded, it looked like some of the fundraising, in fact, the bulk of it, was being exempted from examination. And the political strategies were more, let's focus on the bums in the legislature, when there are legitimate questions about what I'll call legal corruption. A lot of the fundraising that goes on that is the most damaging to the public interest is not based on criminal activity. So you have, for example, what are called housekeeping accounts, which are not subject to many of the restraints on size and reporting and kinds of things that other political fundraising is. These are accounts that are set up to sort of housekeep, that have paid rent, not to be involved in what you call political persuasive activity. Well, in both parties, that seems to have been an area of abuse. I did some investigations in the Rochester area some years ago about the misuse of the housekeeping accounts for empire zones, where if you apparently make contributions to one of the party's housekeeping accounts, you could get your building put into an empire zone for a tax break. Now, that problem was not a legislative problem primarily, and it looked like that an attempt by the Moreland Act Commission to engage itself in that area of investigation was pulled back by the governor. Now, remember, we're speculating to some degree because the Moreland Act Commission hasn't confirmed any of this. But if it were true, it would be a twisting of the purpose of the commission and the attorney general.
If what were true?
If it was true that the governor's staff was saying to the commission, don't investigate certain housekeeping
cases, as reported by Ken Lovett in the Daily News. Go ahead.
Among others.
Yes, well, first.
The point of it being, if you want to look at the intersection of money and politics and its negative effect, it's not about just the illegal acts. It's about a system which legally permits huge sums of money to flow to governors, controllers, attorneys general, district attorneys, and legislators. And you can't just pick on one element of that problem.
Well, you know, Richard, far be it from me to fight with you and your expertise and your superior knowledge. However, I know that he was after the legislature and that this was part of his negotiations with the legislature. They weren't doing what he wanted to pass the various anti-corruption statutes, and this was his big club. Now, you can parse it legally, you know, extra legally, any way you want, but that's what he was doing.
I'm not going to disagree with you, but it doesn't seem to me to be useful to figure out what the hell we do now to get involved in speculation about motives. So let's assume you're absolutely right. Doesn't tell us what the next step is.
No.
And the next step has to be an admission that the big problem in New York is the legal transfer of money for policy, not the violations of law, some of which are quite small, wrong and should be punished, small, and some of which are larger. But the big sin are the huge amounts of money that are transferred. Look, this governor's raised well over $20
million. $29 million in the account right now.
A third of that, if at all, in total. Both are worthy subjects of inquiry. It looks like they were steering away from the big money. That's a problem.
That's right. Finally, we're on the same page. But there's no two ways about it. If somebody gives you money in the New York State political thing, 9 out of 10 times it's going to be because they want something, right?
I would say 100% of the time. Now, some of the things they want are good.
Yeah.
They want a change in policy.
Sure.
They want a marriage between all kinds of New Yorkers to be legal. They contribute. The gay rights community stepped in and gave large sums of money to people with whom they agreed. Now, look, I give you a funny story on it. I was once offered money by a governor of the state of New York if I would vote a certain way on a certain bill. Not political money, but money to put in my own pocket. That was not a secret. That was when George Pataki said to publicly to the legislature that if you vote as I want you to vote on a bill forfeiting salary during the time when there's no final budget, you can have a pay raise in your pocket. Now, I don't think Governor Pataki was trying to bribe people. depending on what the meaning of the word bribe is.
Yeah.
And then, so there's these kinds of interchanges happen because political support is often based upon what you think is right for the state. Political support is often, however, based upon getting something that has a monetary benefit. A large corporation wants a tax break. It starts being politically active. The casino stuff. Casino did not begin to participate politically in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years because all of a sudden they were infused with a desire for better quality government in New York. That's legal. That's my point. That's where the big money flows.
So why do you think this is so profound? I mean, we're all in agreement. Everybody's listening is in agreement. You give people money because, you know, the casinos get in. And in fact, there was a very interesting thing there, wasn't there, Richard, in which the casinos, which were not supposed to be allowed to put money in, all of a sudden were allowed to put money in. And everybody knew it was just, you know, cheap political stuff.
That's a discussion about things like public financing of campaigns, like a number of us support. But not only that, you know, what's interesting about the reform agenda is that it has been remarkably divorced from the things that people normally care about. The great unfortunate truth is that things like political campaign reform and reform of the committee structures and that procedural stuff is by and large not particularly politically potent. Education. Health care. Those are the things people care about. Something I've discussed in the context of a constitutional convention recently. But the attempt to make procedural reform the big issue generally doesn't succeed politically. And I think this is becoming an example of that. People vote for people because of what they'll do to change and improve the quality of life. Not what they do to change and improve the quality of the political class.
Okay, fair enough. I want to go to Shelley Silver. You worked with the man for a long, long time. Extremely bright, brilliant. His people seem to like him or love him. The newspapers go after him, hammer and tong. They try everything they can to get rid of him, and still he stands. What do you make of all that?
Well, I don't think there's a complicated explanation for that, but it is simply that Shelley is probably the best negotiator I've ever met. And when the majority conference of Democrats sit around and talk about things largely in the budget, for example, pre-K over the last 12 or 15 years, that was an idea brought forward by the assembly, pushed and pushed and pushed. And the conference was unified. That's something we want. That's a reform we want. Shelley's skills at maximizing the assembly's impact on the budget, given the constitutional weakness of the legislature in New York, has been extraordinary. So that if you care about education, or if you care about things that I was involved in, reform of state authorities, the environment, Shelley has been able to get good results, largely for the progressive agenda, in ways that nobody else has. That's why he's able to maintain the confidence of his members. He's made mistakes, as have all of us. The explanation as to why he remains Speaker is not complicated. He's done a good job as Speaker, and the members appreciate it.
I've often thought that he's also a fantastic strategist, in the sense that there is no obvious candidate to succeed him. I mean, Denny Farrell, who I love, is the chair of Ways and Means and is 84, 85 years old. So how do you replace someone of that caliber with no one?
Well, I think there are plenty of talented people in the...
Yeah, but they've got to mobilize. They've got to be mobilized.
That may be. But also, the quality of the membership is not a function of Shelley's strategy. Shelley's strategy, and I think we're agreeing, those of us negotiator, his timing is impeccable. It's not that he wins all the time. But if you're a member of the legislature, the Democratic come to Albany, you care about gay marriage, or you care about the Indian Point, or you care about finances for New York City, then the ability of the speaker to make the negotiations yield good results is about the most important thing you deal with. And one of the things I find fascinating is that the real criticism of Shelley has come from the left, from the New York Times, from the editorial boards, who are generally more progressive than, let's say, the Republican Party.
Well, not the New York POST or the Daily NEWS.
Well, more so than the Republican Party in the Assembly, but I take your point. My point is that without Shelley's skills in leading the conference and forming it, the thing that those editorial boards want would never have happened. look at Washington, D.C.
Sure.
For years, the criticism of the legislature in Albany was the speaker was too strong. We don't have, the members are just doing what they're told. Wasn't true, but that was the criticism. Sheep was the shorthand word for that. Now we go down to Washington, all of a sudden we have the same reform as desperate for a strong speaker who can control its members. Democracy is a function of compromise and different centers of power. The fact of the matter is that with all the sins, and they are not to be ignored, the New York State Assembly has been the fountain and champion of progressive ideals in this state for 50 years. And it's going to stay that way, and that's why Shelley holds on to speak.
Okay, there's a period there. Let's go to a couple of things. We only have 8 minutes left, Richard Brodsky, and I want to get your thinking because you were fairly close to this, very close to this for all of those years. Casinos, will they help?
Oh, it's impossible to tell in any definitive way, especially given the uncertainty of where they're going to be. The money for the casino operators is downstate. The economic need, apparently, is upstate. You can look at communities like Atlantic City and see how the casinos can do, for a while at least, do pretty well without doing much for the local economy. Mm. You can look at, for example, the Canadian experience across from Niagara Falls and see where they've done pretty well.
What about the Neville or one of those places in the Catskills?
Again, I just don't think it's possible to know. That my answer to your question, Alan, is I don't know.
Well, you're supposed to know. That's why you're making the big dollars and running.
Part of knowing is knowing when you don't know, Alan. I commend that strategy to you.
Good stuff. Talk to me about hydrofracking. You were close to the environmental movement. It has taken off as the signature part of people's opposition to a certain despoiling of the earth. What do you make of that? The governor seemed to be for it in the beginning and then sort of said, uh-oh, I better get out of the way here.
It's interesting on the merits and it's interesting on the politics. On the merits, the heart of the problem is that the people who have been the advocates for it are essentially the oil and the energy companies. And rightly so, they are not to be trusted. That doesn't mean they're lying. It means that it's their job is to make money and to advance their own interests. Fair enough. Somebody has to be in the position of deciding, for example, whether their general reluctance to tell you what they're injecting into the ground is necessary. That's the government's function. And a real debate should come not by doing ads, but by trying to figure out what's really going into the ground, what the risks are, what the protections are that are available. It was to be hoped that New York State would be doing that. I think the jury is out. The political problem is that this governor has adopted a strategy which I have called pro-gractionary, where he's very, very left on social issues, gay marriage, guns, abortion rights, things I have to agree with him on. But he's been quite quite conservative on economic policy.
Which we said, let me interrupt you because we're sort of running out of time, 5 minutes left, and I know you've written a very profound piece on the Cuomo de Blasio battle. It may not be as obvious to a lot of people as we know, but here you've got this guy who is exactly what you say, very, very close to the ground, got high grades from Republicans and conservatives when he came into office. De Blasio says tax the rich. So what do you get?
But you get a conflict between a guy who has explicitly said, de Blasio, that his first thing is to get a surcharge on the New York City income tax on the very wealthy, people over $500,000, to raise enough money to pay for universal pre-K in New York City schools. And a guy who is facing a gargantuan budget gap left to him by Emperor Bloomberg, which he has to fill in order, one, to provide the city services apart from education, and two, to deal with the question of municipal labor unions who haven't had a raise or a contract in about 3 years. Now, both of those require the consent of the governor. They're laws. They require him to agree to raise taxes on the rich and to increase spending on municipal government.
But he can't do
both
that, can he?
He chooses not to. I don't think it's a choice. Not that he can't, he won't. And Look at the way the battle with Stephanie Miner in Syracuse played out, where
she's the mayor who objected. Go ahead.
She expressed a deep concern, as did other mayors, Richards and Rochester and Spano and Yonkers, that the basic economic model for cities wasn't working, and that required state dollars and state reforms. His response was, A, to sort of smack her a little bit, but B, to essentially lend cities more money, which makes no sense.
Sure.
So the basic principles and policies he set out on finances are in conflict with the basic principles and policies set out by Bill de Blasio. Come January, he's going to put a budget out that he's going to run for re-election on, and de Blasio is going to come up to him and say, no, I need an income tax surcharge and more state dollars. Yikes.
So this has both programmatic implications, but it also substantive implications, but it also has political implications.
Because he is creating a political presence, that he has every right to do this.
You're talking about the mayor.
For re-election and perhaps for a presidential run. This is like the conversations we were having almost 30 years ago, if you recall. So can he run as a progressionary in New York and nationally? That is, a progressive on social issues and a reactionary on tax policy. And in New York, it looks like it doesn't matter how he runs. The Republican Party can't mount a credible attack. But nationally, the Democratic Party is turning to the issues of income inequality and opportunity at a time when Andrew Cuomo is quite firmly buying into the corporate subsidy tax cuts, the strategies that have been identified by the Republican Party.
I like everything you're saying, but I want to ask you a question. If Hillary Clinton doesn't run for president, which is what Andrew Cuomo knows would prohibit him from running, but if she doesn't, does he have a shot?
Sure. He's done some things that are really quite important to credit him for. The government was viewed as dysfunctional. The blame was placed on the legislature, which was partially but not totally true. We had dealt with a governor in George Pataki who sort of lost interest at the end, a governor who came in and sort of self-destructed the legislature, and a governor who was appointed and did not have the resources to sort of govern. Andrew Cuomo comes in, and things start to pop. Now, you can dislike which direction he took the state on any particular policy matter, but he restored the sense, frankly, I think he over-restored the sense of a governor in charge, made everybody look better, including the legislature. The ability to govern is an important public asset, and it's an important political asset. Whether it's enough to elect you when your ideology is inconsistent with where the Democratic, National Democratic Party seems to be heading is a great question, but it's certainly a credible basis for moving forward in a campaign.
Richard Brodsky, we are out of time, and I have so much more that I wanted to ask you. So that just means when we get in touch again, just pick up the phone and say yes, you'll come back, okay?
I'll come back, Adam. Yeah. It's always a pleasure.
We're out of time. Our guest has been Richard Brodsky, former 14-term New York State Assemblyman from Westchester and currently a senior fellow at Demos. Richard Brodsky, thanks so much for joining us. It's always great to hear what you have to say, and we'll be seeing you soon.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Mm-hmm.